Welcome to Confessions of a CEO, powered by RG. My name is Carl Swansbury, and I'm delighted today to welcome Zara Davies onto our Confessions of a CEO podcast. For those few who do not know Zara Davies, Zara is a Northeast born and bred businesswoman. She founded Crafters Companion, which today, 20 years on, she remains to be CEO of. As well as founding, scaling Crafters Companion, Zara first hit our home TV screens as a dragon on BBC's Dragon's Den, where she has successfully invested in dozens of businesses, which she mentors, of course, and also invests in personally. She also since has developed quite a significant profile by appearing on a number of different blockbusters, including Strictly Come Dancing, as an example. I'm really looking forward to spending some time today with Zara to get under her skin, to understand more about her drivers, the things that's important to her in and out of business, whilst perhaps trying to understand a little bit more about how such a busy entrepreneur prioritizes and manages their time, bearing in mind being in two places at once, even for Zara, might be a challenge. I'm really excited to spend some time with Zara today, and I'm confident all of our viewers will take an awful lot away from this podcast. Zara, first of all, I just wanted to say genuinely how ecstatic I am to have you on my Confessions of a CEO podcast today. Thank you in advance for sparing your time.
Confessions of a CEO. I tell you what, that could be, we could get some interesting stuff out.
That is the intention. And genuinely, this is probably one of the most inspiring podcasts I've ever done for two reasons. First of all, not only are you and Simon, your husband, friends, but actually you're someone who I have looked up to for a very long time as a very successful businesswoman from the Northeast. So it's really brilliant.
I would be like, what's he after?
Nothing, actually. It's just nice to give credit where credit is due.
Thank you. Do you know, it's really interesting because people never do that.
Really?
And I know kind of in my everyday life, I take time out to try and do that because I know to give someone a compliment is the best thing you can ever give someone, but very few people take the time to do it. So thank you.
Pleasure. So in terms of today, I'd love to perhaps just go right back to the beginning.
Yeah.
Obviously, I know that you're born and bred Northeast. Can you just tell me a little bit about, I guess, your upbringing and what started to encourage you to be business-minded?
So, I grew up in Cowden, little pit village on the outskirts of Bishop Auckland. And if someone said to me, what do you want to be when you grow up? I would never, ever have used the word entrepreneur, because that's a big fancy word for a young lass from Canada, right? So that would never have come out my mouth. But I did know always that I wanted to be in business. My parents were in business. They've got, it's in fact still got the wallpaper and paint shop in the village. So it's now third generation. My sister runs it. So I grew up in, I guess, an entrepreneurial environment. And I always say to people, and I think a lot of your listeners will hopefully be able to connect with this, is being an entrepreneur is not a career choice. It's a lifestyle choice. You've got to be, like, I didn't know where the business ended and our family life started. My mum and dad's kind of world started. It didn't. It was all one and the same. And growing up in that environment, I kind of knew I was cut out for, I'm happy to do that. So now, you know, there is no Crafters Companion ends here and Zara Davies starts there. It's just all one and the same thing. And I'm good with that. But when a lot of people speak to me and say, oh, I'd love to start my own business. It must be great running your own business. Oh, you can do the school runs and you can take time off and have extended holidays if you want. And I think, my God, you've got no idea. You've got to be prepared. It's part of your life. It's not just what you do as your job.
Totally. And we'll pick up on some of the things you've just referenced a little while. But obviously, as you say, you were born and bred Northeast. With two very hardworking parents who both were running their own businesses. What sort of inspired you to decide to go to York University, I leave the Northeast, and not actually just get straight into the family business?
So do you actually know the answer to this that you're probing for, or is this going to be an interesting
one? It is a loaded question.
It is a question.
And for the benefit of our viewers, I'd love the answer.
Yeah, it was totally the boy. It was, so I met Simon when I was 15, so we really were childhood sweethearts. And you couple that with the fact that I'm a proper country bumpkin. I hate London. I just hate city life. I am just cut out to be here in this, like I'm a real country bumpkin. And so I wanted, I'd met Simon when I was doing my GCSEs at school, and I knew that I wanted to move away from home because my parents really wanted me to go and live away at university and have all of that life. But I wanted to be close enough that I could still see Simon every weekend.
So
I looked, and I was looking for a really good university with really good credentials with the sort of course I wanted to do. Durham was a little bit too close. York seemed absolutely perfect. But to get on this course, you needed 2 A's and a B. And I was worried that I wasn't going to be good enough to get 2 A's and a B because I was predicted 2 B's and a C. And I think having that motivation, I set off in my lower sixth year, absolutely worked my little socks off. It actually backfired a bit because I ended up with 3 A's at the end of the first year. So the school went, oh my God, this is brilliant. We didn't get many kids who like performed that well. We'll put a forward for Oxford or Cambridge. And I was like, that was not, no, that's not the plan. I just wanted to get onto this course at this university. And I remember they said, do you want to apply to Oxford or Cambridge now? And I was like, well, I don't. But I remember going to Oxford and having to do like entrance exams that cost the school had put me forward, but kind of like, I don't want to say flunking the exams, but really not trying very hard at the exams, being terrified that if I actually got in, the pressure I would feel from the family of, oh my God, one of our kids is, you know, someone's going to Oxford. But that wasn't the life plan. I wanted to go to York because I'd seen this course and I could see Simon every weekend, and that was the plan. And thankfully, I got my 3 A's, but I didn't get my Oxford place. So I managed to go to York for the boy.
Awesome. And Simon will definitely watch this podcast. So, hey, I'm sure on reflection, he'll only be delighted that you didn't get that place at Oxford.
That's it. I always say to people, it is all right. I was like, it's all right, because that boy I talked about, I did end up marrying him. Though 25 years later, we're still going strong.
So obviously at York University, travelling back at the weekends to spend some time with Simon. Just talk to me about when you truly started to think about setting up a business. I appreciate that you've always been interested in crafting, but when was it you really thought that perhaps you could set up your own business?
So my motivation had never been to set up my own business. I'd always assumed that I'd take over the family business, because why wouldn't you? My parents had been building this up for 25 years by this point. Surely I would just, you know, take on the hard work that they'd done and take it to the next level. So I went off to university to learn management with a view to taking over the family business. But because it was a sandwich degree, I did a couple of years studying, a year working, and then a year back studying. And in that year working, I remember thinking, well, I don't want to go to London, where all the placements were that the university organised. I said to my dad, I'll just come and work in the shop for a year. And he said, well, what's the point, kid? Because you might as well get some other outside experience, because this is going to be the rest of your life after this. So I thought, fair enough. So I managed to find a placement. It was a friend of a friend, family's decorator. His daughter had started a business. She was looking for someone to help. And I just fell into this placement in a crafting company. And it's not like I harbored this desire to be in the craft industry or anything like that. I went and worked for this tiny little company at a time when the industry was really booming, and I fell in love with the customers. Because people who craft, it's not a hobby for them. It's a passion. It's so much more. And I was like, I love this industry. I had a head full of magic, a load of ideas. And I remember talking to my dad just as I was finishing my placement, getting ready to go back for my final year. And I was like, Dad, I've got all these ideas. And the main was for my envelope maker. And so I've got these ideas. And he was just like, well, why don't you start a business? And my dad must have started, Craig, 50 businesses in his life. His whole thing was, if he had an idea for something, he was starting a business. We would go to the car boot sale on a Saturday morning. Next thing I know, he was buying loads of bikes for cheap. Me and my sister were sitting, taking all the rust off them, and he'd set me grandma up selling a bike shop, the bike shop on the side. You know, my dad had started a business for everything. So his idea was just start a business. So I just started a business. And then the problem was, 9 months later, when I was getting ready to graduate and come back and take over the family business, that little crafting business that I'd just started was now bigger than the family business, significantly bigger than the family business. So it was kind of like, oh, I guess craft is my industry then. And so I had to just learn everything about craft, because I now had a successful business in this industry.
And was the business that you started up Crafters Companion, or was it differently named then?
Nope, that was it. And do you know what? So the first product I had was the Enveloper. But then I had an idea to go from the Enveloper to build in envelope making tools and several other tools into a multi-tool called the Crafter's Companion. So I had this in my mind, but we couldn't think of what to call the company. So we're like, oh, well, we'll call the company the Crafter's Companion, and then we'll worry about what we're going to call this product when we get to launch it. This was like a little invention in the back of my mind, which a couple of years later we launched, and we ended up calling that the Ultimate Crafter's Companion because we couldn't think of another name. So that business was Crafter's Companion. Wow. Really 20 years ago.
Gosh, and when you first founded the business, how did you seed the business initially? Was it just, you know, hard work, blood, sweat, tears, and self-financed to some degree?
Yeah, so I had about $5,000 worth of savings from that first year, the year that I'd worked in the crafting for the other company, $5,000 worth of savings. And I think because of the way I'd grown up, my mum and dad, they'd always just built the business, or in my dad's case, several businesses, with whatever money he had. It was never in our mantra or remit to go and source money from somewhere else to fund what we were doing. Right. We all were self-funded. So I knew that, well, that's just what I was going to do. And that first product that I had the idea for, the Enveloper, as soon as I come up with the idea, then I went to looking to get it made in plastic. And I hit the first hurdle. And that was, oh, well, to launch this product, to make the tool, it's £30,000. It was a company in Hexham, actually. We're going to do all the tooling for me. It was £30,000. Well, I didn't have £30,000. And I think at that point, a lot of people go, well, I have to mortgage my house, or I have to take a bank loan, a really expensive bank loan, or I have to give up equity in the company. But there's always more than one way to skin a cat. So I didn't have the £30,000, which meant I couldn't do that product. But I didn't give up. I didn't stop at that point. It was the next best thing. We made the product in MDF, where I didn't have any expensive setup cost. And yes, I wasn't making as much profit per unit. I could only make a quid on each one, whereas I would have made £3 or £4 profit on each one doing them in plastic. But at least I could still get launched. And I launched, and the first 30,000 Envelopers we sold were what gave me the profit to then be able to pay for the plastic tool. Then the profit rocked up quicker. That profit I then used to do the next thing and build the Ultimate Crafter's Companion. So every time I was building on and using the profits to kind of grow the business. And I did that for a good 10 years.
It's a really interesting thing you say, because a lot of early stage businesses, whether it be a technology business or a product business, they try and develop the perfect product or bit of software before they take it to market.
Yeah.
And of course, that's very difficult to do.
Yeah.
Unless you are successful at raising millions of pounds. So I think that's really insightful, because actually sometimes you know what you're taking to market perhaps isn't the best product.
Yeah.
And perhaps it could be manufactured more efficiently, but actually you've got to start somewhere.
You've got to start somewhere. And I always think the chances of this being the product that you're selling a few years later are so slim.
Sorry.
You've got to get that consumer feedback to make it better. So yes, was that wooden Enveloper perfect? No. But actually, at the time, my idea for the Enveloper was this tool, and it made 9 sizes of envelopes. It had 5 lines on, made 9 sizes of envelopes. I thought it was perfect, and I was making it in wood. It wasn't as good as plastic, but I was going to have to do. Actually, now the Enveloper that we sell has about 15 lines on, and it makes over 1,000 different sizes of envelopes. I'd never had the idea for that product right at the beginning. It was developed as the product iterated, but I iterated with the product. So if I'd never done that first one, you would never have got the ball rolling. And I know it maybe think, oh, it's all right to say that with an MDF Enveloper, whereas ours is a big app or a software platform. But actually, it's the same principle.
Of course it is. So obviously, this year is Crafter's Companion's 20th birthday, which is quite exceptional. And we could spend 10 hours talking about that 20-year journey, but we don't have time on this podcast. So I guess my only two questions are, so obviously you went from a small startup bootstrapped business to a much larger business employing circa 200 people. Mm-hmm. And of course, along the way, you've bought investors into the business to help fund significant growth, I suspect largely internationally. What's the one thing that you would say you've taken away from the 20-year journey when it comes to working with institutional investors?
So what was interesting for me is, so I got about 10 years into our journey before I took any investment. And we didn't actually take any investment into the business. So when I sold the first stake in Crafters Companion, I did it for money off the table.
Right, a full de-risking.
It was a full de-risk only. And interestingly, the business didn't need capital. Yeah. The thing that was holding our business back at the time was, I guess, the bandwidth that Simon and I had running the business. And also, we didn't know what we didn't know. So what I was looking for our investors wasn't necessarily cash. We had millions in the bank. That wasn't the issue. It was knowing what to do with those millions and how to take us on that journey.
Totally.
And I meet loads of entrepreneurs in exactly the same situation. And do you know, honestly, if it was up to me, I would never have done it. And that was the real difference between me and Simon. Simon's an accountant. I'm a full-on entrepreneur, right? I don't even see risk. It's not risk. It's just, if everything goes tits up with something, it doesn't matter. We'll just work harder and make it right. It's not risk. Simon's black and white. Everything's about risk. And, you know, we just bought this house. Beautiful big home. And we'd been mortgage free for several years. And all of a sudden, I bought this beautiful big home. So we had a mortgage. We were wanting to start a family. And then risk, you have a different appetite to risk.
Yes, you do.
And we had investors knocking on the door all the time. I mean, I had so many investment firms chasing me, wanting to either sell the business for me, buy into the business, whatever it was. And I was of the attitude of, I don't want to get on a train that I'm not driving, I'm not in control of how fast it goes, and I'm not deciding when I'm getting off. And in hindsight, that was an incredibly naive way to look at the world. And Richard Harpin came along and was the investor in the business. And he came along and it was such an interesting way. He approached me and he chased me down like you wouldn't believe, desperate to have a conversation with me. And what he said to me is, I think you've done the hard bit in business. Getting your business from 0 to 10 million turnover or 0 to 1 million EBITDA, you've put the foundations in. The journey from 10 to 100 is relatively easy in comparison. And I thought, well, it's all right for you to say. You know, I can't see how to do that. But I didn't have the skills to do that.
He's got the playbook.
He's got.
Didn't then.
That's the difference. And so when he talked to me was, there was the opportunity that we could de-risk. All of a sudden, we wouldn't have the mortgage. We wouldn't have to worry about, you know, the kids in future because we'd have this nest egg.
Totally.
But what that does is it just lifts the lid of possibility. All of a sudden, when you're sitting in the business making decisions on financial risk and everything, you're risking the business. You're not risking your whole life. And that's what I always say to investors is that opportunity to de-risk. I naively would never have taken it because I didn't look at risk that way. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs don't. And because the business didn't need capital, it wasn't something I was considering. But how we felt differently once we'd been de-risked is what enabled the company to go from 10 million to 30 odd million in a couple of years. And it wasn't capital in the business. It wasn't even expertise that the investors brought. It's that feeling and that different environment when all of a sudden the risk's not on you because personally you're taken care of.
So presumably by that you mean because you were able to sell down some of your equity and take some cash off the table, actually you could be more aggressive with how you looked at the business because no longer was all of your wealth tied up in that one business.
Yes. Okay. And Simon would say things to me like, you don't know what's around the corner. You know, something could happen. And the only example he could ever give me is what happens if we've got a big shipment on the water and the ship sinks and then we have all that product goes to ruin and we can't cover and pay that, or if one of our big suppliers goes under and we don't have insurance on them, that could risk the whole business and we could lose the whole business. And if we lose the business, we lose everything. We lose our house, we lose our lifestyle, everything that we've done for the last 10 years, we've got nothing to show for it because everything we have is tied up in that business. And I remember thinking, well, that's never going to happen. You don't just get big things like that that happen that can take businesses down. So that's pointless. But if that's going to make you settle, fair enough. And you know what? Here we are a few years later. Who would have ever seen the pandemic coming?
That's right.
And everything that happened with that. And I remember thinking, you know, that didn't take our business down. But that's the sort of thing that Simon was talking about. Our personal family life was taken care of, which meant that when we're thinking about things and making decisions, we're doing them for the business. It's not the business and our life intertwined. And that's what growing up in an entrepreneurial family had never taught me that, because my dad had never had the opportunity to de-risk. So I didn't know what that was like or what that meant or how that would feel. It's not until I go through it. And hence now, anytime I talk to any sort of entrepreneurs at whatever stage in their journey and they can't decide what to do, I'm always so keen to share this bit of life learning and experience, because I could never have understood what that felt like till I was here.
Totally.
Now being here, and you know, I've had such a journey with private equity and learning different things, I would never, ever change what I did, because that de-risking was the big thing that was the making of me as an entrepreneur.
And for anyone who is contemplating a financial de-risking by bringing in a PE or high net worth investor, what's the one thing you would encourage them to think about outside of the economics?
Yep. So I think you've got to think about your motivations and why you're doing stuff. So I can tell you, as an entrepreneur, and this probably sounds ridiculous, but my number one motivation isn't making money. It's being happy and making me happy. And success is generally what drives the happiness. And it's not always a measure of success can be money, but that's only one measure of success.
Totally.
And the problem is financial institutions, their only measure of success is money. And so you've got to make sure that you are aligned with someone and the values are aligned in how you're doing and the decisions you're making. Because I always say this to entrepreneurs, if you're taking that step, once you step, you can't step backwards. You're on that train, you're going. So you've got to appreciate what your life could look like and how it will change. And there's all of these benefits, but no longer are you making decisions based on what is going to make you happy and what feels nice. You've got to make decisions on what's also going to deliver the greatest shareholder return. And that might not have been your motivation before. And I had a really sticky moment a couple of years ago. We had a CEO in the business. And at the time, he'd been brought in and we'd hired him together, me and growth partner that we were working with. And this guy had been brought in to try and take the company from 40 million to 100 million. And I remember sitting down with him and I said, well, as 2/3 shareholder in this business, I appreciate that if you take the business from A to B, you make me personally about 50 million pounds wealthier on paper. That's a wonderful situation. But the plan that you're going after, the strategy that you're operating, the business that's at the end of it doesn't look like the business to me.
No.
And I don't like the look of that business. And so we could get there. And whereas I'm in love with this business today, I don't think I will be in love with that business tomorrow. And if I don't love that business, you might have made me 50 million pounds wealthier. But actually my life won't change as a result of being that much wealthy, but it will change if this business that I love today isn't in my life tomorrow, because I'm not in love with it anymore. So I appreciate that in your world, your job is just to create equity and value, but that doesn't align with what I want in my life. I need you to build a strategy so that this business that I'm in love with, I'm still in love with, and we have it whereby it's a lot more profitable. And it might take a little bit longer to get there. The prize at the end might not be quite as big, but it's got to fit all of these criteria. And I think that is the biggest difference in the money world. It's just a financial decision. For a lot of entrepreneurs, when they're crossing that line into being just a founder-owned 100% business to working with equity, you've got to have alignment in what we're doing and why we're trying to do it. And that's not to say that private equity firms can't be aligned like that, because a business is always so much more valuable with a founder in it. So growth partner, they were happy. They wanted me to have a business that, even if it wasn't quite worth as much, but was worth a lot with me happy in it, was worth so much more to them.
Oh, without doubt.
Than a business that's maybe got a bigger ticket price, but that a founder that doesn't want to be there. And you read about that so often. You read a lot of autobiographies of entrepreneurs where the pursuit of profit has led them to lose a business that they're in love with.
And without going into too much detail, obviously you are now CEO again, the beautiful business that you founded nearly 20 years back, which suggests, of course, the CEO that was appointed by yourself and growth partner clearly is no longer with the business. How do you think you can now fall in love again with the business? Because, of course, you have been a little distant from the business for some time. So how do you plan to approach that?
I can tell you, within the first week, I was back in love with that business. And it's not difficult because business is just about people. It's just about people. And it's two buckets of the people. It's our staff. And I watched our staff. As soon as I was back in the business in a big way and driving the business forward with the values that mattered to me, the staff responded to that instantaneously. It was an overnight, like a flick of a switch, okay? But also the customers. You know, I'd said before, people who craft, it's not a hobby, it's a passion. And they need to feel that passion from me. And it's like a waterfall effect. If I'm passionate and in love with what I'm doing, that'll spill out into my staff. That'll then spill out from my staff into my customers. And that feeling, you can't, that whole feeling, you can't fake it. You just can't.
No.
And you'll know yourself. If you think about the businesses that you interact with, the brands that you buy from, what is it that motivates you? There's a couple of clothing brands that I love their clothes and I buy their clothes. And really, is it because their clothes are so much nicer than me or the clothes? No, it's about how I feel about that business. And that always comes from the founder. And it's just a waterfall trickle effect. And the businesses that are really successful at doing it, the ones who can scale that and take it to another level. I lost that a little bit in the middle. You know, I didn't find a way to be able to be the founder and be the face of the business, but have somebody else running the business and still be in love with it in the same way. I'm learning how to do that now.
Yeah, which is incredible. At what point did you start to think about, I guess, life outside of Craft a Companion? Because I guess if we sort of go back to when you first appeared on Dragon's Den, I guess to that point, you know, your focus had been, you know, Craft a Companion and mm-hmm. building your single business. So whilst you were incredibly involved in clearly promoting your products on a lot of TV channels and on social media, I guess really Dragon's Den is when you first started to become a household brand in your own right.
Yep.
What sort of encouraged you to start thinking about doing more outside of the Crafters Companion business? Where did that sort of itch come from?
So it comes from a lady in the northeast of England called Caroline Theobald.
Oh, yes. Okay. So I know Caroline.
You'll know Caroline. So about 16, 17 years ago, Caroline recruited me to be a part of an all-female investment group called Gabriel Investors. And we set up Gabriel with a number of other high net worth individual females in the region to go and invest in other businesses. And at the time, all I knew was Craft a Companion. It's all I'd done. And through that, I got to get involved with other businesswomen in the region, most of whom had exited their businesses, made their money, and were now, I don't want to say at a loose end, but were now like, you know, had that itch to do, maybe it's not to start again in business, but to get involved.
Support
the business. And so just mixing with them and getting to do some of the business investments opened my eyes to what life looks like outside of one business. And what I've realized through that is I'm not a serial entrepreneur, not like my dad, where everything was a business. He wants to start a business 10 times over, right? I'm not that. I don't have the appetite to start again from scratch, but it doesn't mean I don't have that entrepreneurial itch that a lot of entrepreneurs have. So by getting involved with other businesses, it gave me the opportunity to do that. So I loved doing it all them years ago. And then it was a by chance conversation that I met him through Gabriel Investors, said to me, I think you'd be brilliant on Dragon's Den. And he actually pushed me and then went through the application process with me to apply to be a dragon.
Wow.
And I just feel like being a dragon was made for me. Like, I love it.
And presumably, until that point, you'd never thought about applying to be a dragon on Dragon's Den. I mean,
honestly, my opinion was all the other dragons were old. So I thought... I thought you had to be old to be...
I think Deborah Mead is not watching this podcast.
I really hope she's not either. All the other dragons.
Yes.
When you see her next.
But I think that's... I had that perception of that, you know, you've earned so much in your career and then you can play it forward. And it was a woman who said to me, but you started your career so much sooner. So you've got a lot of the experience that other people have. Why can't you be a dragon in your 30s? And so I still wouldn't have had the confidence to apply. Bit of imposter syndrome there. He really pushed me. So he went through the process of applying to be on the show, spoke to a producer, said, let me tell you about my friend. She's awesome. She'd make a great dragon. Got me a first phone call. And then from there, I guess the rest history, I took that opportunity, the phone call, went through it. And that's what led to me being a dragon.
Incredible.
But I love that show. And like, I sit in that chair and I get so passionate about all the other businesses that I want to invest in and I want to help and I want to mentor. And it's that kind of serial investor type feel about it. I haven't got the motivation to start another business from scratch, but I'll help you with your business from scratch and I can get involved with it. So that is what kind of took me into Dragon's Den. And from there, I just love TV. You know, I've done shopping TV for over 20 years now. And there's just something about, especially live TV, there's that buzz about it. And then Dragon's Den, I enjoyed so much. And then that started to open up loads of other opportunities for me. And the great thing is, I wouldn't like to be a TV personality as my job. It wouldn't give me the fulfillment that running the business does. Mm. And also, I'm in the happy situation whereby I don't have to earn a living through being on TV. A lot of, you know, I've made a lot of celebrity friends now. I hate that word, but I look at their life and I wouldn't like to live that life, you know, going on loads of TV shows because you need to earn the money from going on the TV shows. I don't need to. I take time out of my job to go on TV. So, and I always say this, like the fee that I'm getting for TV is almost irrelevant because the opportunity cost of me not being in the business of the day is far greater than whatever I'm going to get paid to be on TV. But the fulfillment that I get from doing this is so much different to the fulfillment I get from doing the business. So I've tried to build a structure in my life. It goes back again to being happy. You know, if I wanted to just earn the most amount of money, I wouldn't invest my money in little businesses in Dragon's Den. I'd invest it all in myself because I know I can make that money into loads more money. You know, I would put all of my time into the business. I wouldn't do all these other things because I would just devote all that time to give the greatest return. But actually, my number one motivation isn't just making the most amount of money. It's been having a brilliant, varied life and all these great life experiences that come. This time last year, I was trekking across the Arctic. I mean, who gets to do that sort of stuff in their life? And not only was I trekking across the Arctic, but I was trekking across the Arctic to raise hundreds of thousands of pounds for Comic Relief. And I'm like, that's my life. That I get asked to do this. And that is unbelievable opportunity. And I wouldn't give up anything. So yes, people always say to me, you're so busy and how do you juggle so much in your life? It's because I love it. And I want to be Dragon's Den Sarah. I want to be the investor and the mentor. I want to be the Crafters Companion CEO. I want to do the TV work that I do. I want to present on Morning Live. I want to do new TV shows like Big Idea Works. I want to write books. I want to do all of this stuff because I love it. And if I didn't love it, I wouldn't do it.
You obviously mentioned earlier that you now don't want to set up businesses from scratch. Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, your ambition, your ability, your wisdom, your knowledge, the capital you've accumulated would allow you to do that tenfold. Why would you now not want to go and set up another business or 10? What's sort of stopping you from doing that?
Do you know who I have this conversation with the most? Tuca, right? He's a bit like my dad, serial entrepreneur, and he'll have an idea. And then next thing I know, he's opening up a kiosk in Westfield Plaza because he's launching a business with lipsticks or something because he's had an idea. Or he's launching a new baby product, so he's off to a big trade show to launch. And because he's a serial entrepreneur, he gets that buzz. I often talk about investing and being involved in other businesses, like being an auntie, right? So I've got one sister, and I remember when she had a baby, when she had our little Grace, it was great because I go around. And I've been there and done that. And I can go to it. Yeah, absolutely. It's got a bit of colic there. You just need to do this. Or no, that's a wind issue. Watch, do just tilt her up, do this, rub the back. That'll be fine. That poo's a funny colour. I would check that out. You know, but I can do that and give her all the benefit of my knowledge. And then at 8 o'clock at night, I go, there's your baby. I'm going off for a great night's sleep over here. You can deal with that sleepless night. Right?
Good analogy.
And I just think that's business, isn't it?
Yes.
I don't have the appetite to have all of the work that goes with starting a new business. That's not going to be fulfilling for me. Yes, I could do it. I could do it with my eyes closed and I could probably make a ton of money at it, right? But I'm not going to enjoy that as much as finding somebody who does want to do that and passing on my experience to them. You know, I don't want to have another baby. Loving being an auntie, brilliant. But doesn't make me want to go and have another baby again. And it's exactly the same thing with the business.
You talked about imposter syndrome, and we've got to spend a few minutes on this if we can, because I think a lot of people, whether it be your own business, mm-hmm. whether it be you are elevated in a large corporate yep. to a very senior level, perhaps at a young age, I think a lot of people sometimes feel that they're having a bit of a sort of out-of-body experience because they are in a position that they never thought they'd be in.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess the first time you appeared on Dragon's Den was probably that. How do you deal with being in a situation where you think, I'm not worthy, but of course someone's put you there, so yep. you must be. How do you deal with it without sort of coming across as clumsy or anxious? Yeah.
Do you know, I've suffered from it all my life. And you were right. I sat in the Dragon's Den on the first series thinking, how on earth did I get to sit in this chair? I'm not good enough to be here. I've got to just fake it till I make it, pretend that I am. And even running the business, you know, I've only recently become CEO. I've never been CEO of that business for years because I didn't think I was good enough to do that. Like, I didn't have a piece of paper from university that said I was qualified to be a CEO. I hadn't been there and done that and got the T-shirt. So I was looking at that business thinking, it deserves better than me. I'm not good enough to be that person. So I think women especially, but everybody deals with imposter syndrome at some level. And what I always say is, quite often in a situation, and it's a reflection that's helped me understand this, and it's reflecting on Dragon's Den, I wasn't the one who decided whether or not I was good enough to be a dragon. That was not my call. I'm not qualified to make that decision. I'm not. The commissioners at the BBC, the head of the BBC made that decision, the executive producer, they are the ones that were looking at all the different options, deciding who was good enough to bring the person and sit them in that chair. They decided, and they are qualified to say whether or not I'm good enough. So who am I to question their decision? My job then is to sit there and think, right, people think I'm good enough to do this. I'm going to work my socks off to show that they were right in seeing something in me. And it's the same at work. I often say to my staff, you know, I'll put people forward for promotions, or I'll move them into roles that is probably a bit further on than when maybe where they thought they were. That's because I can see something in them and I can see that potential. And I need for them not to question it in self-doubt, just trust that I've seen something in you and I'm going to put you forward for that. And I always say this, especially when I go into big corporations and organizations, I say, trust the process. If someone's put you there, they're seeing something in you. And I think women especially, we always look for the negative, and we want to think we're not good enough to do this. And it sometimes takes somebody else seeing that in us to put us forward for something.
Yeah, it's almost like third party validation, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That you are worthy. Not that one should question whether you are, but I think we're all human yep. fundamentally. So going back to when Caroline and your mutual yep. friends said, Zara, you've got to apply for Dragon's Den, and you're thinking, these guys are bonkers, but let's give it a whirl. Did you then, in your mind, sort of have a real interest in creating quite a significant profile for yourself? Or actually, were you genuinely just going along for the ride and seeing what might happen next?
Do you know, it's really interesting because when you first talk about it, it was never going to happen. It was just an opportunity. I'll never get the job, so it doesn't matter. And then when we finally get to the point where the producers are going, yep, we've decided you'll have this, but I want you to think about it over Christmas and make sure that you definitely want this. Then I then went and talked to the family. And in speaking to the family, ironically, nobody was in support of me doing it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What was the reason?
So Simon, my husband, didn't want me to do it. And my dad didn't want me to do it. My mum didn't want me to do it. And when I dug into the why, they were just like, we don't need it in our life. Like, we don't need the celebrity. We don't want to be going to Tesco and people stopping you for selfies. And we don't need all of the media attention that comes with it. And I think it's Cheryl Cole had just done the whole trying to crack America thing.
Right.
And then got slated in the press. So my mum was terrified that people were going
to
write
nasty things.
So protective.
I get that.
She was terrified that people were going to write nasty things about me in the press. And so she didn't want me to be exposed to that. And my dad was just worried about what would the impact on our life be. All of a sudden you're parachuted and people talk about your net worth. It still pains me to this day that you go and Google me and the number one thing that people Google is Zara Davies' net worth.
Nice.
That's the thing that it comes before knowing who you are as a person. And he said, we don't want that life. And he's right. We didn't want that life. But the difference is there's so much I love about being on Dragon's Den, about the other TV work that I do, that I accept that this is the payoff. And I make it work for me. And, you know, touch wood, the press are really kind with me because I think I'm a nice, good person. And because I set out to just do things with positive intent and be nice and good, and there's good in my heart,
yeah.
I think that's very much reflected in what you see in the press.
Of course it is. I think it's nice to be nice in business, and I think you can be highly successful in doing so. And, you know, if you look at other sort of business programs, like perhaps The Apprentice, where actually, you know, Sir Alan chooses to be a bit more aggressive, chooses to be a little bit perhaps more direct in the way in which he deals with the candidates. Perhaps, you know, you are bringing a different angle and a different, more honest perspective to business, which clearly people appreciate.
And you know what? There's a real pressure on me to be a role model in that area, because quite often what I will get, and again, it's women especially will stop me and say, it's lovely to see that you can be in business and do things the right way.
Totally.
And be kind and be thoughtful. But don't mistake kindness and niceness with being soft. And I think it's quite nice, because sometimes in the den, you get to see my teeth a little bit. Doesn't mean I haven't been fair and I haven't been thoughtful and kind, but I've still been quite direct. And it's nice to role model that and show people this is how you can do business. It doesn't have to be this perception of how people think, oh, you've got to be old school, you've got to be aggressive. Business doesn't have to be like that. And hopefully I'm living proof that it doesn't.
So let me ask, obviously, you know, whilst you are vastly experienced, you are no doubt still continuing to develop and to learn as an entrepreneur, as an investor. And what's the one thing you've learned from being on Dragon's Den, from your fellow dragons?
Oh, what have I learned from the other dragons? Do you know, I sit there every day and I feel like I learn something new every day watching them, the way they interact with the businesses. And I think, you know, I learned something great from Deborah this year, actually. And it really stuck with me. And, you know, when you have a running with someone and afterwards, if they've been wrong, they'll come back and they'll say, oh yeah, I'm sorry. And you can just, because they think we'll say sorry and we'll move on, right? Deborah said to me this last year, you don't have to accept that.
Yeah.
You don't have to accept someone's apology. It's perfectly fine to say, okay, I hear you, we can move forward, but I don't really accept that apology. That wasn't acceptable to do that or treat me this way or whatever it is, but I'm prepared to move forward. And do you know, I try to teach my kids this lesson. One of my youngest had a run-in with a kid at school a couple of weeks later, and the kid had done something, and then he'd just come to apologise the next day. And I remember saying to him, you don't have to accept his apology. You can still move forward, you can still be friends, but it's perfectly acceptable to say to that kid, no, what you did wasn't right, and it's not acceptable to do something like this and then just say sorry afterwards. So I'm not accepting that apology, but we can still move forward. And it was such a valuable life lesson to learn at 40-year-old. And I immediately thought, I'm going to take this and I'm going to own this, Deborah, and I'm going to teach my kids and I'm going to share it with as many people as possible. And it was really eye-opening for me. But it just shows, like, and literally every day I'm learning something new in that den, but that was a really big life lesson I took forward after last year's series.
No, sometimes, you know, you can't be liked. And sometimes, actually, it's okay to accept that perhaps parting company is the right next step, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think that does come with maturity and experience, doesn't it? Obviously, you are just such a very busy person. You know, you've got now Crafter's Companion, full-time CEO. You know, you've got two boys and Simon, so I'm sure that keeps you out of mischief. You've got a beautiful house, which we're in today, which, of course, no doubt takes a lot of time and attention in terms of upkeep. And we've just talked about Dragon's Den. We haven't even talked about Strictly and all of your other interests. Or how do you prioritize? How do you find time for that?
I always think my biggest golden rule for everything is being present in what you do. So I can't give anything in my life as much time as I would want to, but it's about the quality, not the quantity.
Mm,
yeah. And it kind of plays into being a mum. And I always say, you know, being a mum, I maybe don't have as much time with my kids. You know, I have some other mum friends who gave up work completely to be with their kids full time. I could choose to do that financially, but it wouldn't make me feel fulfilled or happy as a person. So actually everything is a payoff and a decision all the time. So what I do is I choose to spend my time doing what I'm doing, and then I own that decision.
Totally.
And I just say, do you know what? In the time I'm being a mum, I'm going to be the coolest mum. I'm going to be the best mum. I'm going to be the mum that all the other kids want to be friends with and they want to come play at our house. I can own that. I can make that brilliant. But I'm not a full-time mum. You know, I'm also a career woman. True. I've got all these other things going on in my life. And so same with Crafters Companion. I'm not 24/7 in that business like other people are in their businesses. I can't be. It doesn't work for me. I've built a setup that works for me, that allows me to have my other things going on in my life as well and get that balance all the time. But I always decide whatever I'm doing, I'm being present in that moment.
So given that, do you ever find yourself feeling a little compromised? And by that I mean, Zara, you know, do you ever feel like you're not giving the boys enough time? Do you ever feel like you'd like to spend more time in Crafters Companion because you know the impact it would have? Do you ever feel like you're just doing a lot but not doing anything to the best of your ability?
Life is one huge compromise. And the day I made peace with the fact that I couldn't do everything 100% every day is the day I think I started living life a bit more. So if I look, and it was before I had kids, I lived to work, and it was perfectly fine to leave the office at 10 o'clock on a night and not have a life outside of this and just give it my all. But that was fine because I had my all to give.
Totally.
Soon as I had kids, actually priorities change in life. I want the business to have my all, but I'm leaving work at 5 o'clock because I'm having the night with my kids. And as soon as you have that, you learn to prioritize and you think, right, I can't give the business 16 hours today. I can give it 8, but I have to make those 8 hours count.
Right.
I have to make sure that they get the 80% of what they need from me because they can't have the 100%. And it's choosing those decisions. It's exactly the same with the kids. You know, I'm not here every weekend, every day. I don't see every single football match. So what I do is the ones that I get to, I make them count. I make the time I've got special. And also I don't chastise myself for the stuff I don't do. You know, I remember I made both school nativities this year.
Awesome.
Both school nativities. And I was so thrilled with myself. I didn't make sports day last year. And I was devastated. But when I think back on last year, do I think, oh, I didn't make sports day. I'm a really shit mum. I think, no, I made both nativities and I'm thrilled about that. And I think it's important to celebrate the wins, not focus on the failures.
Well, that's right. It's perspective, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And as you say, you can dwell on the things you'd like to do more of if you like, or you can celebrate the things you do.
Yes.
And that's a mindset thing. My last question for this podcast, because we could sit and chat all day, but sadly, time will not allow us to. So my last question is this. Fast forward 20, 30, 40 years. Now, what is the one thing you hope, when all is said and done, people remember Zara Davies by? What is the one legacy you really want to make sure you leave?
I hope that I am the person that other women, especially, you know, women but people look up to and think, she could do it, and so there's no reason I can't. And whether that's because you're a woman, or you're a trailblazer in your industry, or you sound a little bit like this and everybody assumes you're therefore not as good as what they are when you set out in this, or you want to do business with heart, you want to do things the right way. Whatever it is, I hope people look up to me and think, well, if Zara Davies can do it, then I can do it. And I think it's that being a role model is the biggest privilege I get to be in my life, but it's the biggest responsibility at the same time.
That's right.
And so I live every day trying to be the best version of myself, not only for me, but for other people to be able to role model. You can't be what you can't see. So I really hope that, you know, in 20 years time, in the same way that people I look up to, people look up to me and it was me that inspired them to be able to do something.
Zara, thank you. I think we've left this podcast on a very inspired high, and it's been fantastic to spend some time with you.
Well, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. These are always my favourite type of chats, so I hope people take at least a couple of little nuggets of information from it.
Thanks, Zara. It's been an absolute pleasure today to spend some time with Zara Davies on our Confessions of a CEO podcast. While Zara, of course, is a highly successful, highly influential businesswoman who has over recent years become highly profiled as a consequence of appearing on the likes of Strictly and Dragon's Den. Actually, she's just a very honest, very warm, very down-to-earth woman. It's been inspiring to understand the things that are important to Zara, accepting that being in business is not all about creating capital. It's about loving the business you're building and loving the people within it. Certainly from Zara's perspective. It's been really interesting to understand how Zara manages the need to continually find a balance between home life and business, And as Zara said today, fundamentally, life is all about compromise. And therefore, as long as you find a balance that works for you, that, hey, probably feels like success. It's been great to understand a little bit about sort of how Zara has dealt with imposter syndrome. And I suspect that many of us, whether it be in our business or somebody else's, if we are employed, have probably had to deal with and overcome. And I think finally, actually, it's been really nice just to hear a little bit about perhaps how Zara has gone about developing herself as an entrepreneur who is fully focused on actually helping other business people perhaps have the confidence to set up and scale up their own businesses. And I think at the end of the podcast, Zara's legacy, which is to inspire others to know that they can achieve what she has achieved for sure, without doubt, is something that I highly respect and find personally very inspiring. Today, you've been watching Confessions of a CEO with Zara Davies. My name is Carl Swansbury. If you would like to download this podcast or any other podcast in our series, please do either via YouTube or wherever else you download your podcast. But for now, it's been a pleasure, and we look forward to seeing you on future Confessions of a CEO podcast.